Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In just a moment, we'll be joined by Dr. Eric Dykin, a sleep expert, a neurologist, to answer your sleep questions and also comment on some of the latest sleep research. But before we turn to that focus, let's get a quick update about some significant breaking news from late yesterday. State officials have been blocked from enforcing Iowa's law against school-issued mask mandates. This after a federal judge ruled in favor of families challenging the law. IPR reporter Grant Gerlach joins me now. Hello, Grant.
Hi, Ben.
Tell us more about this ruling, what it means.
Yeah, this came from a case that was brought in federal court by a group of 11 parents along with the ACLU and the Arc of Iowa, Disability Rights Iowa. And they were challenging this law passed back in May, where the legislature, as part of the law that they passed, HF 847, they said that schools cannot issue mask mandates. That's the basic gist of it. And so they were challenging that law because they said it discriminates against their children, who have disabilities and various health conditions that put them at high risk if they were to catch COVID-19. And the judge agreed with them to, at least for the time being, to temporarily issue a restraining order against enforcing the state law. It doesn't take it off the books, but for now it means that the state can't enforce the law against any districts that do choose to require masks.
And what's been the reaction from school districts?
Well, there are some districts that are acting pretty quickly, especially Des Moines. They acted right away and said that they will reinstate a mask mandate starting tomorrow. So all students, staff, and visitors to Des Moines schools starting tomorrow, they'll have to require masks. They'll have to wear a mask. And they said they had indicated that if the law were blocked or if something changed and they were allowed to make that decision, that's what they would do. So it wasn't a surprise that they acted quickly. Several other districts are planning to meet today or tomorrow or this week to discuss whether they want to issue a mask mandate. Today we have Iowa City. It's making this issue part of their meeting tonight. Ankeny is having a special meeting to look at it. Johnston and Sioux City are some of the ones that I know are planning to talk about it tomorrow, and there could be some others that come up, or just as school board meetings come back around, this could be something that comes back up. There were 11 school districts that were part of this lawsuit, but this really means that any district around the state could decide to require masks in schools, mm-hmm. which is what the CDC recommends.
Right, and Governor Reynolds has always stood firmly for this ban on mask mandates, saying it should be a decision of parents, right?
Right. So she was unhappy with this court ruling. She said the federal judge in the case, Robert Pratt, overturned the state law. He ignored the decision of elected lawmakers to pass this law. And also this goes against the wishes of some parents for their children to not wear masks at school. And not all schools were requiring masks last year. It was pretty common. And so I don't expect all schools to turn around and require them this year. There are some places that probably won't take that step. So it becomes an issue now for the school boards to take on this debate again.
Mm-hmm. Judge Pratt ordered this. This is temporary. When will this and how quickly will this be? We have an ultimate decision that holds.
Well, so the lawsuit goes forward, but the state is appealing Judge Pratt's decision on the temporary injunction mm-hmm. blocking enforcement of the law. So that appeal will go to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. It'll just kind of move up the chain there. We don't know when a hearing would happen on that just yet. So that's something we'll be watching for in terms of the timeline of this. And it means that if it were overturned, in appeals courts, or if the lawsuit ultimately failed, then this order would go away. It just all depends on what happens next. But from Judge Pratt's position, he decided that in his ruling, he wrote that you kind of have two laws in opposition here. There's the Federal Americans with Disabilities Act, and then there's this state law that says schools shall not issue mask mandates. And in his judgment, it's the federal law that trumps the state law when it comes to measuring one against the other. The state had argued also that there were some outs from this law. They pointed to a provision that says schools can require masks in a targeted sense if they have to do it to meet a federal requirement, for instance. Mm-hmm. But Pratt ruled that's not good enough because some students may be able to raise that threshold, but they might have siblings who aren't covered by the ADA, for instance, and they would still be exposed to the virus if their sibling were in a classroom with classmates who aren't wearing a mask. So it was his ruling that it really should be an option for schools to issue these universal mandates.
Okay, a complicated controversy there. Glad to have Grant Gerlach of IPR to explain the latest developments there. State officials have been blocked from enforcing Iowa's law against school-issued mask mandates, and superintendents are free to have those mask mandates now. And as Grant just mentioned, some have. Grant, thank you so much.
Yep, glad to provide an update.
And we'll be talking about this for sure tomorrow on our Politics Wednesday edition of the program. Developments bound to come between now and then and throughout the week. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And now back to the main event, if I may term it that way. Dr. Eric Dykin, director of the Iowa City VA Hospital Sleep Lab. Welcome to our program.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing well. I hope you are doing well. And we want to invite our listeners to join our conversation with the sleep experience, a sleep problem, or perhaps you have a sleep remedy that we could perhaps learn from. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us river2river@iowapublicradio.org. We'll tackle some of this. Have you comment on some of the latest research here? A peer-reviewed study, before we go to callers, a peer-reviewed study published by the journal JAMA Neurology finding that people who sleep 6 hours or less every night had elevated levels of something called beta amyloid. Tell us what you think of this study. Is this reinforcing other studies along these lines?
Yeah, and we've talked about this before, especially in older individuals, people with dementia, and people with head trauma. There's this theory that in the deepest stage of sleep, the most refreshing stage of sleep, people say, slow wave sleep, N3 sleep, all these different terms for the special qualities of deep sleep. It opens up the brain system, they call it a glymphatic system, for clearing out proteins that aren't wanted. So we know that when we have our activities of daily life, there's a metabolism and there are waste products as far as preserving the body's state of health. And those waste products with urination and defecation and with sleep may be cleared. If you don't get that stage of sleep, with sleep deprivation of less than 6 hours, there may not be adequate clearing of the system. Mm. And these proteins that are a waste product can build up and actually promote dementing illnesses such as Alzheimer's disease, which is typified by accumulation of beta amyloid and amyloid plaques.
Mm-hmm. This is quite a significant study because also because of the large sample sizes recorded, 4,400 men and women aged 65 to 85 included in this, 67 sites, the U.S., Canada, Australia, and Japan, according to the lead of this study. More than 6 million Americans living with Alzheimer's, according to the Alzheimer's Association, kills more than breast cancer, more than prostate cancer. And perhaps you can comment on this, doctor. Deaths due to Alzheimer's have increased 16% during the COVID pandemic. Why would that be?
Well, you and I in private have talked about this. I have lost a parent, my mother, my father, and my father-in-law within the last 5 months, and they had dementing illnesses. Prior to that, we couldn't visit them because of COVID. They were isolated, and you know, it's implicit during the day. I was a nursing assistant. My mom made me do that when I was a youngster. And if my patients that I was taking care of were sleeping during the day, I would let them sleep because it was just such a tough job. It was just so tough with taking care of so many elderly people, trying to keep them awake and active. And we're becoming an older and older population. And with this older and older population now in a nursing care facility where family and friends can't stimulate them during the day, get them exhausted, if you will, so that they get the good prolonged sleep at night and that you can help monitor and take care of with the nursing care system. I think that's an element behind that. Mm. We're not giving the best care because we've isolated not just our young, our middle age, but our elderly people, and they're not getting a normal life. And, you know, we've talked about all the other insomnias, nightmares, and other problems related to COVID and the immunocompromisation. Our immune system with less sleep is also compromised. And what are old people privy to? Infections such as COVID. So, you know, we could go on and on about that, but it's not surprising.
Mm. If you've just joined us, Dr. Eric Dykin, director of the Iowa City VA Hospital Sleep Lab, neurologist, sleep disorders expert, join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Email rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Let's dive into what a number of our listeners want to have addressed, restless leg syndrome. We have an email, a caller on that. But before that, let's make sure we set the foundation, doctor. It goes by the acronym RLS, Restless Legs Syndrome. What is it?
Well, it's actually a symptom, a complaint complex, which means it's a subjective complaint that a patient will have. And it's really defined by the acronym URGE. It's the urge to move your legs. It's worse when you're at rest, especially at night. If you get up and go, the G, U-R-G, get up and go, you move the legs, it gets better. And again, E, it's worse in the evening. So U, urge to move the leg, R, worse at rest, G, get up and go, it's a little bit better, E, worse in the evening. So it's a symptom complex that a lot of people have, and I get it if I'm on long trips, long traveling trips, especially flights. It's so a lot of similar symptoms that a lot of us get.
Mm-hmm. I see it shows up more in as people age, occurs twice as often in women than men, tends to run in families. Let's go to our first caller. Patty is with us in Des Moines. Hi, Patty.
Hey, I've been taking 400.
Yeah. You struggle with restless leg syndrome?
Yes, I've taken modafinil for 15 years, then suddenly I couldn't fall asleep and stay asleep, so I went on 75 milligrams of trazodone. But then with that, I started taking 600 milligrams of calcium. And then when I heard you're on today, it made me think maybe that. So now I'm on Promexipol, 0.5 milligrams of Promexipol.
Okay.
Does calcium have anything to do with restless leg?
It's incurable, but how can it be treated, doctor?
Well, in the old days, so with restless leg syndrome, they believe it's related to a relative dopamine, this neurotransmitter, this chemical in the brain called dopamine, a relative deficiency in certain areas of the brain. And a lot of people get it. So we've often seen it with iron deficiency, anemia, which iron is a cofactor for the production of this neurotransmitter, dopamine. So what we used to try to do was replace it with dopamine, the medication, which often is found in this formulation called Sinemet, that's also a treatment for Parkinson's, but again, these people aren't at risk for Parkinson's. And we found out that it's hair of the dog that bit you kind of a thing, that the treatment itself really improved the symptoms, but over a period of time, the symptoms would return, and they would return worse. So this adaptation was a negative thing. So we've turned to different medicines, and one of the better medicines that we've been using has included gabapentin and a variety of different medications that have worked, but often imperfectly. And it's very interesting that many things can exacerbate a sleep disorder, including restless legs. Mm-hmm. And that includes poor sleep habits, insomnia, stress, and pressure. So we try to take care of the whole person if we can, and we often almost promise you. So if someone promises you they're going to cure you of something, you ought to ask a second opinion on that. It's rare that we get rid of 100% of those symptoms, but we can often see an improvement with a variety of these medications. But the dopamine we often avoid because it will often exacerbate the problem.
Mm, okay. Thank you, Patty, in Des Moines. Here's a related email. David, I think, here writes, related to restless leg syndrome, my wife says that my legs twitch all night long and have for years. I didn't know this was happening until I was married. It doesn't affect my sleep, to my knowledge. Is there any cause for concern? So he has restless leg, or is this something else? Because he's not even aware of it, says David, our listener.
Yeah, and what we would call that is periodic limb movements in sleep. And a lot of people get periodic and limb movements in sleep. And a review that I had done years and years ago, about 64%, or at age 64, about 45% of all people have this little twitching in their feet. Neurologists call it the Babinski movement. The toes sort of flare up, and it can actually have a little bit of a jerk with the legs. And if it didn't bother you, it's benign. It's no big problem. It's not an indication of any underlying problem. Now, restless leg syndrome, one of the correlates, concomitant problems you can see is really severe periodic limb movements of sleep. So on occasion, we'll do a sleep study, and we'll see somebody with bad restless legs, and they have lots and lots of periodic limb movements in sleep as a correlate of the disorder. But the disorder of restless legs doesn't need a sleep study, and you don't have to have the jerking of the legs or the arms. It is that subjective complaint of the restlessness that gives the diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. An email on this topic as well from a Dr. Pramodi identifies himself, or she does. Can we diagnose restless leg syndrome on a sleep study, which you just answered, but or a primary doctor? Can the primary care physician diagnose it without a sleep study?
Well, that is amazing. We had the famous Dr. Pramod, who is a well-known family medicine doctor from Cedar Rapids. Yes, and I think he wants to make sure that everyone out there knows that your primary care physician can diagnose this. This is not something you need a $5,000 sleep study to diagnose. And in fact, if you wanted to try to diagnose with a sleep study, third-party payers will refuse it because it's a clinical diagnosis. And the general practitioner, your ARNPs, your PACs who are trained, and many of them are now, it's a mandate of a lot of our BIRD certification to know about these sleep disorders. Yes, you can get that diagnosed clinically with an office visit, and you don't need a $5 million examination for it.
All right. Exaggerating a bit, if you're insured, out of pocket, a sleep study costs what? What's the ballpark figure there?
Oh boy, I think they're up to $4,000 to $5,000 last time I checked.
Okay.
Now, sleep studies again are not necessarily supposed to be done for anything other than sleep related breathing problems and people with central hypersomnolence, often known as narcolepsy or idiopathic hypersomnolence. So you're not routinely doing the facility, the in-lab studies for sleep apnea. If you have no major other health problems, you can do a home sleep study, and those are relatively affordable. Off the top, I'm not sure what those are costing now. Depends on the type of home sleep study you're getting, but they are much, much, much cheaper than an in-laboratory study, and we frequently do those every single day at the VA.
Okay, Dr. Eric Dykin with us, and we will take a break in just a moment. We have time to talk with Gary from Cumming, Iowa. Gary, I see on my screen you may have something that anybody can do to lessen restless leg syndrome. What do you find working for your son?
I'm not licensed to practice in this state or anything, but I have my own theory of it. And my theory is that, you know, I base it, you know, on muscle, attributed to muscle memory. And I figure, well, okay, if you have, you know, your muscles, they remember and they want you to exercise. And so I can feel my restless leg coming on during the day, and my recipe is to go to the Y, and I just get on a kickboard and I kick like crazy, and 99 times out of 100 I can sleep that night. I mean, if your legs need to move, then move them, and eventually I think I just give my muscles their fix, and on I go.
Sounds like great common sense, Gary. Thanks for calling, Dr. Dykin. Sounds like common sense. Is that for some people a real therapy that they can practice?
Well, not just a therapy for restless leg syndrome. It is a generally exercise we know that you can tolerate, can increase core body temperature, and good low-level exercise or tolerable exercise for the individual, and that's a bell-shaped curve, increases what we call the N3, the deeper stage of sleep, if you will, of the slow-wave sleep that we talked about, even with the dementia studies, is also important to get that 7 to 8 hours of sleep every night, if you will, the sweet spot.
Okay, we have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes with Dr. Eric Dykin, neurologist, sleep disorders expert, director of the Iowa City VA Hospital Sleep Lab. What's been keeping you from a good night's sleep? Tell us about your sleep problems, perhaps an unusual sleep experience you or a family member have had, or perhaps, as we just had from Gary, a remedy for bad sleep, restless legs in that case, that works just fine for Gary. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. When we come back, more research as well about how bad sleep can impact performance, cognitive performance, up to a week later. We'll have the doctor comment on that when we return. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org. Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer, today with Dr. Eric Dykin, director of the Iowa City VA Hospital Sleep Lab, neurologist, sleep disorders expert. Join us in this conversation with your sleep anecdote, a sleep problem, perhaps a sleep remedy. 1-866-780-9100. Mixing this in with Dr. Dykin's comments on the latest in sleep research studies out there as well. But our phone lines have a good number of people want to talk to you, Dr. Dykin. Let's go to Jeff in Dubuque. Welcome to the program, Jeff.
Yes. Hi, Ben. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing. What's going on?
Well, I have a situation for you. I sleep and I dream so deeply that I become involved in these dreams so where there are action sequences, I start doing kung fu moves and things. Or if I'm being chased by somebody or I'm breaking away from them and things. And, you know, it's gotten to the point where, you know, my wife and I have gotten a bigger bed, and we put barriers between us. So, because, you know, it just happens. So
how long has this been going on, Jeff? How long have you had this?
Oh, for quite a while, Ben. And yeah, it's, you know, if I'm watching that, if I'm dreaming that action movie, I am in it and I'm moving.
Okay, Jeff, Dr. Daikin, normally our systems, our sleep system paralyzes us so that we don't do what Jeff is doing. What do you think's happening here?
Well, and, you know, the Latin term, I guess it's Latin, I don't know, oneric behavior, which means you can often exhibit elements of the dream that you're having, the behavior like chasing a rabbit or something, and people can be watching you, and you look like you're asleep, and you can almost guess what they're doing. And that's best paralleled if anybody's ever had a dog or a cat.
Yep.
And that dog and the cat has slept, and you see them, you know that they're chasing the cat, or the cat is fighting the dog. They're hissing, they're you know, these little jerky movements. That's oneric behavior. And so during the deepest stage of sleep, REM, which is rapid eye movement or dreaming sleep, we're generally paralyzed to some extent so we don't act out the dreams and hurt ourselves. But there are two phases of dreaming sleep, phasic, and that's where you can jerk, you know, like you're trying to move away or towards, like the dog chasing the cat or the cat defending itself against the dog and hissing. And then there's the tonic, where you're just not moving at all. So as we get older, there are some disorders, and that's not what Jeff is talking about, where we can actually lose that relative paralysis, and people can get up out of the bed and act out, and they tend to act out violent dreams. And that's called the REM sleep behavior disorder. And again, that's what we often see in the laboratory and in the clinics. And we can do clinical and then laboratory diagnostic studies to differentiate those two. But he seemed like it was pretty amused with it. And I don't know. Ben, you got a dog or a cat that's ever done something like that?
I have, and I've observed my dog doing the running action many, many times. Now, I guess, Jeff, the question for you is, yes, you seem in good humor about it, but Dr. Daikin, I guess the question would you have for Jeff is it a problem? Obviously, it's causing some problems with Jeff, your spouse, because you're...
Right?
So
And my concern is that she's going to wake up black and blue, and they're going to say your husband's abusing you, and that's not the case at all.
Dr. Daikin, if Jeff wants to follow up here, primary care physician, a good first stop always. But other than that, what advice do you have for Jeff here?
Well, you know, and Jeff alludes to the fact that this can be a very serious issue, and there have been crimes where people have been have had inappropriate sexual behavior, violent behavior, where people have been actually killed, and they wonder about sleep-related violent behaviors. One of the things is you want to make sure that you do have an evaluation if it's getting to that point. Because the REM sleep behavior disorder, we can treat with medications. And a sleep study will often not pick up the violent behavior, because that's not a thing that often causes every night. But what we see during REM sleep, during a facility-based and in-laboratory study, is that there is not paralysis. And we call it REM without atonia, which means without paralysis. So you see muscle tone elevated, and that's often a diagnostic element for REM without atonia, where then you can then consider medications like clonazepam or melatonin. Now, the other thing that often leads to violent-related dreams, and I think, Ben, you and I have talked about it, that's what I had. I had horrible dreams of drowning and fighting through raging waters, waking up gasping, and sleep apnea. Is a thing that millions of people have in the United States, undiagnosed often, and that's where sleep apnea is worse because of the lack of tone at the back of the throat. The throat closes off in REM sleep, dreaming sleep. And what you will do, and it's called the activation synthesis, you will be feeling like you're drowning, and you will create a dream of fighting to get out of those raging waters. So we often would go to, and Jeff, I'd recommend that, see your primary care doctor, they know about this, and see if you need an evaluation with a sleep laboratory. Do you have sleep apnea? If you treat that, this should get better. Do you have REM without atonia? If you treat that, this should get better. I think Jeff has voiced the concern, oh, absolutely. If you're my relative, I have you see your primary care physician about this.
Okay, very good, Jeff. Thanks for the call. And let's move on now to West Des Moines. Jan is with us in West Des Moines. Hi, Jan. What's yours?
Hi. I have a question. I have angioedema, idiopathic, that wound me on a ventilator. And I'm under the care of an allergist immunologist, and I take 20 of Zyrtec, and she put me on Singular. And because these attacks usually occur about 5 hours after I've gone to bed, because I'm so afraid of them, you know, I have an EpiPen and I don't want to have to call 911. But if I can abort the attacks, I do have like Benadryl and prednisone and more Zyrtec to take, and it usually stops the attack. So because of my fear of it, I have been going to bed between 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning, and I set my alarm clock for like 4 times, just so that I can wake up and test to see, okay, is anything happening? Yes or no. And as a consequence of that, I am chronically tired, agitated, and I also have bipolar disorder, which requires a very good sleep hygiene. So I guess my question is how much am I screwing myself up doing this? And perhaps I can try to deal with the fear so that I can fix my sleep a little bit. So,
yeah, a complicated situation, Jan. Let's see what the doctor has to say in your case.
Well, you know, the paradox, oxymoronically, setting your clock every few hours is absolutely contrary to good sleep hygiene. So you're not practicing good sleep hygiene right there. And my thought is, you really need to sit down with the doctors that are specialists in angioneurotic edema and see if they can give you comfort that you're not going to die in your sleep from this. I think that's one of the first things you need to do. And what we call stress and pressure is the number one cause of insomnia, difficulty in sleep, and that's what you're describing. And what we often do to treat this, the fancy term for sleep hygiene is cognitive behavioral therapeutic interventions. And cognitive behavioral therapy begins with cognitive therapies, and as I'm implying with talking to your medical doctor, knowing what is common sense in regard to your primary disorder. Are you really at risk of passing away, going to sleep, if you have those medicines that you're on? And I think your doctor can assure you and give you the comfort initially that this is not a thing that is going to routinely be taking you in your deeper stages of sleep. Then what we follow is the stimulus control. Having a routine, a positive Pavlovian conditioning that your bedroom is an area of relaxation, not setting the alarm clock 4 or 5 or 6 times, where it is now inviting, you feel comfortable, what your physicians have said, what your therapists have said, knowing the medicines you're on, that you're in a safe place. This is your safe place. So you need the Pavlovian condition that you are going to get to sleep positively. You are going to do well. Sometimes that's the third element of cognitive behavior is progressive relaxation therapies and things that the psychologists and psychiatrists are really expert at. Me telling you over the radio, well, just cool out, calm down, it's going to be okay. That only goes so far. It's like telling our young veterans from Afghanistan, it's okay. It's just okay, and they're going to have a cure of the post-traumatic stress disorder. I think that professional counseling in your case and in many of our cases is very, very important. And then sleep restriction, I don't think that's an issue for you. That's the fourth element of cognitive behavioral therapy. You're already getting poor sleep. I would start out with a sit down with the team, your healthcare team, and try to get that positive attitude and approach to sleep. If, though, they think you have another disorder like sleep apnea, I do feel sometimes getting a facility-based or a home sleep apnea test to rule that out so that you know that you have a normal night of sleep and you're otherwise safe as can be. Because how do you know if you have sleep apnea? Because not everybody snores, gasps, wakes up with a headache. But we haven't even gone into that. So remember, when you're trying to get therapeutic recommendations from a guy on the radio, be real careful. I think you need to sit down with your healthcare team and just use bits and pieces of what I've said. But remember, I'm only on the radio. I haven't really seen you in real life, and I haven't looked under the hood to make sure that you don't have kissing tonsils or some other medical malady. So good luck to you, but go talk to your team, healthcare team, and see what they think.
Thank you, Jan, in West Des Moines. Good luck with your sleep issue there. Dr. Eric Dykin is indeed a qualified MD and a neurologist, has studied and researched sleep disorders for many decades. He's currently director of the Iowa City VA Hospital Sleep Lab. I had to throw that in, doctor, because you were making fun of yourself a little bit too much, perhaps. We do have a qualified expert on the air here. We've got so many people who want comments here, so we'll rapid fire through some of these quickly as we can to get to as many as possible. Nancy in Robbins, her first comment, she says all the stats about how the lack of sleep puts us at risk for various diseases, Alzheimer's, for instance, only increases anxiety and worry for those of us who find it difficult to sleep. It's not like we're deliberately refusing to go to sleep. Many of us just can't shut off our, I'll just say, bleeping brains. she says one thing that's helped her, which she says we haven't addressed, is a sleep podcasts. Sleep With Me, she names. I've used melatonin to no effect, over-the-counter prescriptions, no effect. But the podcast has been the most effective, she says. A pair of cheap earbuds and my Kindle. She says, I'm usually out in 20 minutes. I do not know this podcast, Sleep With Me. Maybe they're reading the telephone book, doctor, on this podcast.
Well, I don't know. But what people, and what she's implying, too, is anxiety is the number one cause of insomnia, poor sleep. And this is a stressful world, and almost three-fourths of all Americans over a one-week period have a major problem with sleep or sleep, and it's 3 to 5 times per week. It's an anxiety-provoking world, and what we often find is we need to find someone who can help us get that sweet spot, find what causes us to relax, and we often use imagery that is relative to ourselves. This individual uses a sleep podcast. I use my dad's old classic illustrated comic books. They remind me of Dad, and I read 3 or 4 pages. I think it was just on Mutiny and the Bounty, and it relaxes me, and that's my method for fighting anxiety. But I think, as she says, the more they tell us about the world and health, etc., sometimes you just got to go downstairs and watch cartoons or Mutiny on the Bounty with Marlon Brando. Pretty good movie.
All right. Bob is with us from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Bob. You're with Dr. Eric Dykin, a neurologist. What's your issue, please?
Yes, sir. It's this new therapy you're advertising, Inspire. It's been on CPAP for a long time. Is it worth the complications of the surgery and such?
Well, you know, Inspire does something very similar. It's a hypoglossal nerve stimulation, which means they stimulate with a wire, an electrical stimulation, the muscles in the tongue that push it forward to open up your throat when you go to sleep. You can do the same thing with an oral device, a mandibular advancement device, the MAD device. So my good buddy, Dr. Parker, who's retired from the College of Dentistry here, he got me one of these oral devices, and that's what I use. The Inspire is the company that makes the hypoglossal nerve stimulation. It does the same thing. It's $36,000. It takes a while to get that approved, but it's a wonderful therapy for people for whom it works. And, for example, if you have no arms, We have had many of our vets have lost their arms. They can't put in an oral device easily at home. If they had this simple device, they could often bend down, push on this little button, and at night it will act as an oral device, or like the CPAP mask. How can you put on a CPAP mask without arms? But I think it's a wonderful therapy if you fit the criteria for it. There are some very specific criteria for that, but consider the oral device and the hypoglossal nerve stimulation device. I think they're both wonderful if you fit the criteria for them, sure.
Bob in Cedar Rapids, thanks for your call, sir. All right, let's go to Brian in Ames. Welcome to the program, Brian. We're coming up to the end of the hour. What's your sleep issue?
Yeah, I had restless leg syndrome back in the day, and I had a hip replacement. And that was about 15, 16 years ago, and the restless leg syndrome went away.
Immediately.
Is there any correlation to that? Yeah, pretty much immediately.
Absolutely.
Yes.
You know, you and me, we're blood brothers. I've had both my hips replaced, and there is nothing more painful in the world than a bad hip. I mean, how many people do we know who have died after a broken hip? But there are many discomfort elements of this urge, the restless legs, that are very similar to arthritic pain, neuropathy pain. And again, when you have the kind of pain that you have with total hip requiring a total hip replacement, it just makes restless legs much worse. They can often even mimic or exacerbate it. So not surprised, and then good for you. Good for you.
Okay, Brian, the success story there. Very good. Thanks for sharing that. All right. Will is with us. Will joining us from Johnston. Hi, Will.
Yeah, hi. I had a question about the length of time your lymphatics might be engaged in a standard 8-hour sleep cycle. I never get 8 hours of sleep. I get maybe five. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, but I very rarely remember my dreams. So I'm wondering if I'm just getting deep sleep.
Yeah, how much of that typical 8 hours is deep sleep? What should it be, Dr. Daikin?
Well, again, so deep sleep is different from REM sleep. So, you know, about of the dreaming sleep, it's about 20-some percent of your total time in sleep. The issue is, and I think I'm similar to you, my tendency is to wake up early in the morning for a variety of reasons. Early morning is where REM sleep is densest. And if you tend to get up early, you tend to have less REM sleep. And it's those people that tend to sleep 8 hours that get that amount of dreaming or REM rapid eye movement sleep. So you have to put in the hours to really get that dense, heavy amount of dreaming sleep, the 8 hours. So people like you and me, who may not routinely sleep 8 hours, we just don't put in that debt to get to REM sleep, and that's just not unusual. Yeah, usually REM occurs every few hours and gets longer toward the morning hours. If you're sleeping less, you're just not going to dream as much.
Will, is it affecting you? You say you sleep about 5 hours a night. Are you functioning well?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I tend to wake up. I fall asleep easily. I just tend to wake up 3-4 o'clock, and then I'm kind of restless from there until I get up.
But no sleepiness no sleepiness or lack of concentration during the day?
Sorry, that was just a little joke. No.
I get it.
Fine. I seem to function okay. So.
Okay, very good. Dr. Eric Daikin, and you've talked about this before, applies to Will's case. Different folks need different lengths of sleep there. 5-6 hours would be, it's possible you can have healthy sleep with that length per day, isn't it?
At the feet of the bell-shaped curve, there are short sleepers, but they're really very rare. But as he says, he tends to get up early. And if he's like me, over age 50, and with all due respect, because I'm well over age 50, is what we consider elderly in sleep. And we tend to phase advance, which means we go to sleep earlier and we wake up earlier. It's just the way it is. It's part of an aging sleep cycle. And he wakes up earlier, and that may be one of those issues also. And, but, you know, across the board, because the society demands us older people, we tend to stay up because it's when all the action is occurring. So we tend to be a bit sleep deprived. And one of the things you've got to be careful about is the last thing a sleepy truck driver remembers before falling asleep behind the wheel of a 40-ton rig is being wide awake. And by the way, we have the safest truck drivers in the world in the United States because they monitor them for their sleepiness all the time. They know that. But you often can fool yourself with how sleepy you are and how well-rested you are. I get highway hypnosis, and boy, I'll tell you, when I drive for any prolonged period around noon, I get sleepy. So there are different cycles. There are the feet of the bell-shaped curve, but we often underappreciate how sleepy we really are until something happens.
Dr. Daikin, we have to go. It's been wonderful spending the hour with you. Thank you so much. Director of the Iowa City VA Hospital Sleep Lab, Dr. Daikin, thank you, and thanks for all our callers. I'm Ben Kiefer.
Thanks,
thanks for joining us, everyone.
Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.